As before, Whisper had not challenged her, content to pass her days reading stories of fairies and sprites written on parchment bound into books, painted with bright, gay images on their leather covers. Whisper had paid a fortune to have them written just for her by a famous Dreadnoughter storyteller. Though Raven had encouraged her to come to court on numerous occasions, her sister had yet to stray far from her room. Nightly, Whisper awoke screaming, terrified by the nightmares that now plagued her. Raven had taken to sleeping in her bed to provide as much comfort as possible, but she knew it wasn't sustainable, not forever.
"Empress," Goggin said, snapping her away from her thoughts.
"How far into the desert have the Easterners sallied?"
"Half a league, perhaps a little further. Not far enough to be of concern just yet. But they grow bolder by the day."
"Ships?" Goggin shook his large head.
"None that we have seen thus far. They seem determined to wage this war on foot."
Raven soaked the information in. This kind of news was bad for everyone. If she did nothing, she would appear weak, and her people might lose confidence in her. Then again, Fire had chosen to be aggressive, and where had that gotten her? She bit the side of her mouth, using pain to chase the memory away. Though a month had passed since her sister's death, the sting was still there. Sometimes the pain was as distant as a star, and other times as near and hot as a flame pressed to her skin. Fire had been a lot of things, but forgettable was not one of them. Lately, however, she'd fought the sadness with anger, rage, letting it coil inside her like a snake. Why can't the Easterners just leave us alone? Why can't Calip remain an island, cut off from the rest of the Four Kingdoms, living in peace? "We must strike back," Raven said. Goggin nodded.
"I agree. My only concern is that the new Guanero are not yet trained."
"Double the training hours. Dawn until dusk until they are ready." Goggin blinked, but then he said,
"As you command."
"And the dragons?" Raven asked. The Dragonmaster, Ryder, stepped forward. "None will be mature until next year." "But can they fight?" Ryder's eyebrows dipped. "Empress, you heard me." Raven couldn't believe that a month ago she had been on the opposite end of this argument, siding with Ryder against her sister. Now she finally understood how hard a decision it had been for Fire to leave the dragons in Calypso while they rode to war. "If you hadn't listened to me, sister, would you still be alive?" It was thoughts like that that made her want to scream and throw things. "Yes, they can fight," Ryder said. "But I would advise wit good," Raven said, cutting her off. "I will attend dragon training on the morrow, and make a final decision by sundown." Raven couldn't meet Ryder's eyes, couldn't bear to see the disappointment in them. "As you command," she said, spinning on her heel and leaving the court. Goggin had already left. None remained but the ghosts of Raven's past. A noise made her turn. Whisper stood in the shadows of the curtain blocking the exit into the courtyard. A single tear rolled down her cheek.
"You're going to leave me too, aren't you?" she said.
Though her eyes sparkled, the predominant emotion in her tone was anger, much to Raven's surprise.
"Whisper, don't apologize. Don't you dare apologize."
Raven closed her mouth, standing. She parted her lips once more.
"I won't apologize. I have a duty to protect our people, our lands. What about me?" "Yes, you too. Then don't leave me. It is tradition that the Empress rides to war with the Calypsian army,"
Whisper finished, wiping the tear tracks from her cheeks with the back of her hand.
"I know. I was tutored by the same scholars as you, sister."
She spat the last word. Raven had never seen such ferocity in her youngest sibling. Then again, she was a Sans, an heir to the dragon throne, so it was inevitable it would eventually come out.
"What would you have me do?" "Stay." "I can't." "Then call off the war. Then no one has to go. We can wait and see what happens. Let the other kingdoms destroy each other. That was what Fire wanted, wasn't it? That was her big plan?"
"Only partly," Raven said.
Once our enemies were weak, Fire wanted to march on them. She wanted to go to war. Before the battle in which she called herself a weapon. She said that was her only purpose in life.
But you're different. You're not like Fire.
Once Raven would have agreed with her sister. But now, she wasn't as certain. Sometimes she felt like she could summon fire at will, as if flames lived in her veins the same way they had in Fire's. No, I'm not Fire. But I am the Empress now. And I will not sit on the dragon throne while the Guanero ride to war.
Then I challenge you for the throne,
Whisper said defiantly.
Whisper, it's too late for that.
Whisper backed up a step, the curtains swirling around her, the Calypsian sigil shifting over her head.
I hate you,
she said, her mouth a snarl. And then she slipped between the curtains, vanishing like a stone dropped in a dark pool. Raven sighed and slumped back into the throne. She banged her head on one of the dragon's teeth that roared from the back of the royal seat, but she didn't have the energy to rub the spot, which was now throbbing fiercely.
You can hate me, she thought, but I will protect you until death, just as Fire did.
47. The Southern Empire, Fanes, Fenia. Bane Garrick. 1 month later. As he watched Emperor Hosa sleep, Bane considered whether to kill him. Vin Hosa seemed so peaceful, his diamond-studded skin sparkling in the candlelight, as if violence was a cloak he pulled on when he awoke each day, not a part of the man himself. Bane almost laughed at the absurd thought, but managed to stop himself. In the end, the beggar had been wrong. Taking one's own life was never the answer. Bane now knew that better than anyone. Though the hooded man hadn't spoken much, at least he was a companion, a friend. Unfortunately, however, the one marked with the plague had tried to take his own life before carrying out the mission Bane had given him. Though he hadn't been tired, Bane had rested with his friend for a long month, nursing him back to health. A month wasted, although it didn't seem that way. Another month without peace. His mark had left him alone, and for a while he'd wondered whether the prophecy was done with him. He'd wondered whether he'd failed his creator, the one Bear Blackboots called the Western Oracle. During this time, Bane, like his friend, had once contemplated suicide. But that was a distant memory now, as fuzzy as the snowfields of the north. No, he was once more determined to fight for peace to the very end.
I should kill Hosa in the name of peace, Bane thought.
Now that Empress Fire Sands was dead, he could feel her death in the very marrow of his bones. Three more true monarchs had to die one way or another. It was the only way there would be peace. And yet two had already died in the south. Only two rulers in each of the four kingdoms were supposed to die. The south was finished. He should be going elsewhere, targeting a ruler in one of the other realms. But he wanted this so badly. Needed it, like water on the lips of a man dying of thirst in the desert. Bane raised his knife over the slumbering man's head, the blade hanging in the air like a trembling icicle.
Why am I hesitating?
He knew the reason. The beggar hadn't killed. Well, he had killed in the past, but after meeting Bane, he tried only to take his own life.
Why?
Bane wondered. If someone born with a mark meant to kill, like his, was able to resist his very nature, should he do the same? The answer came in the form of a growl in the dark from his own throat.
No, I am death.
Hosa's eyes flew open at the sound, his lips opening to utter his command to make Bane his slave. But he never got the words out, never uttered a single syllable, his windpipe severed in half by Bane's knife. Bane wrenched the blade out, cleaned it on Hosa's bare stomach, and then slipped it back in its sheath.
Six, he thought.
His father, the dread King of the North, King Wulfric Garrick, King Gil-Loren, his uncle. King Oran Ironclad, Juggernaut of the East. Empress Sun Sands, the Dragoness.
Empress Fire Sands the Fire Marked, and Emperor Vinhosa the Slave King. 6 steps closer to peace in the 4 kingdoms. 2 to go. He felt a fire on his scalp as another section was filled in. Strange. He hadn't expected it to do that when he'd killed 3 southern rulers. The fire continued, growing, different than usual. Surprised, he moved quickly over to where a tall, thin looking-glass rested against one wall. He dipped his head so he could see his own scalp. How? He wondered. For there, on his skin, his mark had changed, grown. The circle was larger now, and split by 5 arrows rather than 4, creating 10 sections. 2 more than before. 6 were filled in. 4 remained. 4. How is this possible? Bane wasn't certain how to feel, but the overwhelming emotion that coursed through him was, to his horror, excitement. He'd thought he was getting close to fulfilling the prophecy, but he wasn't. There was still much work to do. He was still needed. And there were so many monarchs left to choose from, warmongering rulers who deserved to die. Who is the most deserving? Bane wondered. Queen Rhea Loren had wiped out the Northern Army using a sea monster. But was she really the queen? Her brother, the peacemaker, Rhone Loren, was older than she, the lawful heir to the Western throne. And what of the North? The dread king's brother had fallen, but now there was word that his niece, my sister, Bane reminded himself, Queen Anise Garrick was travelling to the hinterlands to regroup. I should have killed her when I had the chance. And then there was the heir to the east, Gareth Ironclad. He may have handed the Ore Throne to his brother, but he was still a threat. In the south another Sands might have to die. There was talk that Empress Raven Sands was considering an attack on the east. Or, Bane thought, I could just stay here in Fanes, and kill the Slave King's heir Falkenhoser, who will soon learn that he's the new emperor. Would his mark grow even larger with more sections if he did that? The thought excited him. No, thrilled him. Decisions. Options. There's no hurry. I have time, and I must rest after my latest kill. After all, the 4 kingdoms had waited more than 100 years for peace. They could wait a little longer. Suddenly exhausted, satisfied that his work there was done, Bane reached down and picked up the dead brown pison which he'd killed when he first arrived in Hoser's bedroom. Gently, quietly, he placed it on the bed next to the dead emperor, letting the snake's blood mix with Hoser's. All across Fanes, slaves startled awake, rubbing their eyes. Though they'd only been sleeping for a few hours, it felt as if they were waking up from a decades-long sleep. One by one they realized, I am free. Some wept. Some screamed at the top of their lungs. Some laughed like it had all been a bad dream. But Jai Giroo did none of those things. When he awoke in Garadia, chained to the wall next to the hordes of rejoicing slaves, he felt only horror at having led most of his people to their deaths just before they would have been free. 48. Unknown location. Chavos, previously known as the Beggar. Unknown time later. I am Chavos. He sat up quickly, half-blind, his mind spinning. Where had those words come from? Who had spoken? No, no, no! Instinctively his hands probed his stomach, exploring the rough stitches where he'd plunged the knife into his abdomen. He winced at the pain. The wound was still tender. I am Chavos. That voice again. It is my own, he realized, but from the past. I am the Beggar, he said, but that wasn't right either. The fact that he could speak wasn't right. The fact that he could feel his heart beating in his chest, hear his ragged breath slipping between his lips, wasn't right. He was supposed to be dead. Hello, Chavos, a voice said from nearby. He twisted his head to the side too fast, his head pounding.
Who's there?
Your friend. Your brother.
That familiar voice.
Bane.
Though he spoke the word like a curse, he felt relieved. He wasn't dead, but maybe there was a reason for that. Maybe this was a second chance.
You made a mistake, Bane said.
Chavos knew he needed to lie.
Perhaps I did.
There's work to be done still.
Yes, there is.
Chavos lay back down, his pulse racing. One of them was going to die, that much was certain. And it wouldn't be him.
49. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhône Lorraine. 1 month after Gareth Ironclad's suicide attempt. Rhône was finally leaving Night's End. The delay was a strategic one, as Rhea had received word of some unrest in the south. Something about a slave revolt and an attack on the Southron gates by the Calypsians. It was better to be patient, she had counselled. Not that Rhône had any say in the matter. He'd been locked in a room since Gareth's suicide attempt. It was a nice room, but that didn't change the fact that it was a prison. He hadn't been allowed to see Gareth, Gwen, or even his younger siblings, Bea and Leo, though he'd requested visits on multiple occasions. Rhea sometimes came to see him, but only to remind him that if he didn't obey her, that Gwen would be hurt, killed, if necessary. She never threatened Gareth. No, he was far too valuable. Rhône had given up on trying to understand his sister. Obviously bad things had happened to her, but he didn't know which tragedy had turned her into this cruel creature she'd become. The death of her father, perhaps? Or maybe it was seeing the palace littered with bodies after Bane's murderous rampage. Or it could have been the murder of her eldest cousin, Jove, just after he'd become king. One of the guards had told him that Rhea had witnessed it. A trail of blood seemed to follow his sister. Rhône wished there was something he could say to bring her back, to convince her this path she was on was wrong. Unless, of course, she was always this girl. That was a possibility, too, though he hoped not. Rhône blinked away his thoughts, refocusing on his one opportunity to see a friend before he departed the west. The dungeons were dark and moist. Trailing Rhea's long white purity dress, Rhône's footsteps echoed in the stone corridor. They passed several cells on the left. In each was a prisoner, although hunched and cowering in the corners, they hardly looked human any more. In one cell there were two curled-up forms, so small they might have been children. Rhône felt sick. Would he find Gwen in a similar condition? He wished he'd never come to Night's End, wished he'd never left Calypso. If this is my fate, if this is what it means to be the peacemaker, I don't want it. Rhea stopped at the next cell. A voice said, "What in Orion's name do you want?" And Rhône's heart leapt in his chest. He rushed the last few steps and looked between the bars. "Rhône?" Her silver hair was knotted and greasy, hanging in limp vines. Her face was smudged and dirty, her form-fitting armour dull and in need of a good polish. But unlike the other prisoners, she was still standing, still strong, her golden eyes alight with a mixture of anger and surprise. "Gwen," Rhône breathed. "I'm so sorry." He'd been wanting, no, needing, to say that to her for weeks. "No one forced me to come with you," she said. "I wanted answers, too. But I trusted my sister. I fell into her trap." Rhea laughed, but they both ignored her. Gwen said, "It's not your fault. We didn't stick to the plan, either. Yes, we came to the meeting place at dusk, but when you didn't appear, we caused a scene. We banged on the doors. We shouted." Rhône didn't know that. He'd wondered how they'd been caught so quickly. He'd always just assumed it was his fault. Regardless, none of them would have been there if not for him. But there were worse things still to talk about. "Did you hear about Gareth?" Gwen nodded. "She told me." Rhône glanced at Rhea, who smiled cruelly. "As Gareth's friend, I thought she should know."
She came to hurt me with her words, Gwen said. She said you saved him, though.
Roan shook his head.
It wasn't me. It was my mark.
Same thing? He shook his head harder. Gwen said,
Don't start doing this again, feeling sorry for yourself. You don't get to do that, not while I'm stuck in here. I'm getting you out. I don't want you to get me out. I don't want you to save me.
Her words shocked him. He moved forward, gripping the bars.
Don't say that.
She took a step forward, but remained far enough away that he couldn't touch her. Her voice softened and yet took on a stinging quality.
Roan, I will never love you like that. So you should stop loving me. Gareth, too. He only loves what he can't have. It has always been his way.
Roan blinked rapidly.
I won't.
He wasn't certain who he meant, Gareth or Gwen.
Then you're a fool.
He knew what she was doing, trying to push him away so he wouldn't do what Rhea wanted. So he would escape the first chance he had, disappear and never return to Night's End. Right? Or was there truth to what she said? He'd seen her demons. He knew they haunted her. Perhaps they wouldn't let her love. Not ever again. Or maybe she could just never love him as more than a friend. Perhaps Alistair had taken her heart when he died all those years ago. Sadness washed over him as he realized, I never even got to kiss her the way I wanted to.
Enough, Rhea snapped. Reunion over. Time to leave.
Wait, Gwen said.
No one tells me to just let her speak, Roan said.
Rhea flinched, surprised by the outburst. Despite everything she'd done to him, Roan had never let his anger take control around her. Rhea said,
Very well. Say what you have to. It's the last thing you'll say to him for a very long time.
Gwen took another step forward, but was still out of reach.
Leave the West and never return, she said.
When Roan finally looked back, Night's End was a smudge of gold on the horizon. They'd ridden hard for a long time, and he'd trained his gaze forward until now. He didn't want to think about who he was leaving behind. He was surrounded by red-clad Furia, who would escort him as far as the Snake River. He wasn't certain whether they were there to protect him or guard him. He didn't care either way. Gwen's words kept coming back to him, how she would never love him the way he loved her. That Gareth didn't really love him either. He didn't think of her words because they hurt, no, quite the opposite. The more he listened to them playing over and over in his mind, the more he could hear the truth written in them. Or, more correctly, the opposite of the truth. Gwen was lying. Though she'd tried to mask it with harshness, it was there, as obvious as sunlight reflecting on a pool of water.
She already loves me. I know it. Gareth, too.
At least that's what he kept telling himself over and over. It's what he needed to hear. He spurred his horse on faster, determination coursing through his blood. He would travel to Calip, to Citadel. And if the Western Oracle or her son, Bear Blackboots, were there, he would find them. And yes, he would bring them back to Night's End, but not in chains. No, they would come with sword and spear and marks of power. He would save Gareth. He would save Gwen.
Nothing will stop me, because it's my destiny.
50. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Rhea tugged her purity dress over her head. For the first time in her life, she was glad to wear it. The dress's bagginess was coming in handy for her current situation. She tossed the dress on her bed, her hands automatically coming down to rest on her belly, which was a lot rounder than it had been even a few weeks ago. Her small breasts had grown, too, ample bulges on her chest that reminded her of her old nursemaid, Selma. The nausea came and went, and was usually the worst in the morning. Food helped a little, when she found time to eat. Rhea rubbed her fingers against her smooth, pale skin, as if trying to feel the life growing inside her.
My child, she thought,
a mind going back to that night with Grey Aris, a night that had changed everything in more ways than she'd realized at the time. But no, it wasn't Grey's child, would never be his child, regardless of how it was created. Just as Ennis could no longer be her cousin, but one of her many guardsmen, his face shrouded beneath his helm. She would never be able to tell her people the truth about him. But she would tell her people the truth about how she would soon have an heir. At first they would be in shock. How could Rhea the righteous, Rhea the pure, Rhea the brave, be with child? How could she have committed such a grievous sin out of wedlock? And with whom? And that's when she would make the declaration that would secure her place in history, more so than even her momentous victory in the Bay of Bounty. "I am a virgin," she said now, practicing her facial control. "My child is born of wrath." And they would believe her, raising her pedestal even higher, all the way to the heavens. Yes, she would have her war, and they would be her pawns as she seized the four kingdoms by the throat. This is the end of Book Two, but the story continues with five postlude stories in the fate-marked epic series. Keep listening after the credits to hear more. You have been listening to Truthmarked, Book Two of the fate-marked epic. Produced by Greg Lawrence. Associate producer, Emily Durr. Text copyright 2017 by David Estes. Production copyright 2017 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved. Postlude 1. Bear Black Boots. The Northern Kingdom. Circa 352. Back then, he wasn't known as Bear Black Boots. Back then, he was just Henry, a boy of 16, undersized for his age, timid and quick to tears. On this night, the tears wouldn't stop falling, a waterfall of despair, streaking his pale cheeks so smooth he might have been a boy only 10 name days old. His mother had been sentenced to die, and die she would on the morrow, burned to ash by fire as Western law required for condemned sorceresses. The thought drew a fresh wave of tears from his eyes, blinding him as he stumbled along the dark, stony corridor. "She is all I have. What will I do?"
"Hurry up, boy,"
the dungeon master growled, shoving Henry from behind. He tripped, almost falling, but managed to steady himself with a hand on the rough wall. Heat washed over him. He'd almost plunged headlong into a torch. He squinted and jerked away, the thought of fire on skin bringing bile to his throat.
"I don't want to do this. I don't want to see her. I just want to go home."
It was too late. He was already here, manhandled to the front of the cage, holding her. They called her the Black Witch. They called her the Western Oracle. They called her Evil Incarnate. Once she'd been known as the first of the Three Furies, a wrath-loving woman who advised the king on spiritual matters. Henry knew her only as Mother, the woman who kept him safe, who fed and clothed him, who comforted him when he awoke sweating and screaming in the throes of one of his night terrors.
"Dear Henry,"
his mother said now. Her dark hair was unwashed and greasy, hanging in listless curls to her shoulders. Her eyes were a rich brown, flecked with forest green. She wore a dirty brown dress, the dress she would die in. Already, the other Furies and their followers, the Furia, had adopted the practice of dyeing their own hair red to distance themselves from their condemned leader. Her long, spindly fingers reached through the bars, trying to touch Henry, to wipe away his tears. Even as a prisoner, she thought it her job to comfort him.
"Mother, no,"
Henry said, shaking his head. However, his actions belied his words, and he fell into her arms, letting her cradle his head in the crook of her shoulder and chest.
"Hush, sweetness, for the night carries a weight of its own enough for all of us."
Her words, as always, felt like a wash of warm breeze on his skin, melting through him, calming his heartbeat and nerves. She was doing it again, using something unnatural, something that went against the laws of wrath to make him feel
right. Nothing was right. He wrenched himself back, tearing his small-framed body from her grasp. His feet tangled together, and he tumbled backwards onto his rear, the stone rough and cold through his baggy trousers.
"Henry,"
his mother cooed.
"You fear me, too?"
He bit back tears, swallowing hard.
"Never, mother. I could never. Come here."
Once more she held out her arms. He wanted to. Wrath, how he wanted to.
"I can't,"
he whispered, the words seeming to rip out his breath as they escaped his lips. He felt empty inside, numb.
"Henry?"
He looked down, inspecting his feet, those narrow, short boots that were small enough to fit a child. 2 years earlier, his mother had had them custom-made for him by the best bootmaker in the realm, a man named Vaughan. Henry still hadn't outgrown them, a fact he was teased about mercilessly by the other boys his age.
"Touch my hand, Henry,"
his mother said, and this time it was a command.
"No,"
he thought.
"Not a command, not exactly. A spell."
He began moving forward, marvelling at his mother's power.
"Who can cast a spell with naught but a few words? And if she can, why doesn't she save herself? Melt down the bars, break through the walls. Perhaps the Furies are right. Perhaps my mother is too dangerous to live."
He hated himself for thinking it. Of its own accord, his hand reached out to meet hers. He stared at it, willing it back. But his body was no longer his own. Her fingers were surprisingly warm as they threaded through his. This was what she had become. It had all started when they'd gone on a journey south, beyond Fanes and Calip, sailing across the burning sea, all the way to Tarragon. A journey of revelation, his mother had called it. She'd never been the same since.
"Henry,"
she said, her eyes pouring into him, as if they were liquid copper, seeming to fill his entire field of vision.
"I need you to gather my notes, my prophecies, to hide them across the kingdoms. They shall not be found until their appointed time."
He wanted to speak, to say all the things he'd been feeling, to release his anguish, his fear, his desperation, but his mouth was sealed shut. Again, his dark thoughts about his mother returned. No one should have that kind of power, should they? Not that it mattered. He knew he would obey, as he always had. His mother's eyes rolled back into her head. He wanted to look away. "Please, look away." But couldn't. His eyes tethered to hers by a force he knew he might never understand. She spoke, the timbre of her voice deepening, like someone else was communicating through her.
"Their hearts will fail, their lives will end, but yours will last, it will extend. Beyond all measure on land or sea, from skin to skin, from teeth to teeth."
The dungeon master growled something unintelligible, stepping forward. On the edge of Henry's vision he saw the man freeze. The hunched prison keeper strained to push forward, but an invisible force held him back.
"She is doing it. Does she control us all?"
His mother continued speaking, the second stanza of what was sounding more and more like one of her poems, her prophecies. "Fang of wolf and fur of bear, to warm, to change, to save, to tear, a climb to the mount, a jaunt through the wood, their fates will be yours. To help them is good." With a swiftness that took Henry's breath away, his mother's eyes rolled forward once more. She blinked. Whatever force held him to her was gone, and yet he refused to pull back, to let go. Like so many of her other words, Henry didn't know what these ones meant. All he knew was that something had changed forever. He could feel it in his bones, in the beat of his heart, in the breaths pulling themselves in and out of his lungs. He could feel it in the silence, and in the growl of the dungeon master as he was released.
"Enough," he snapped. "Your time is up."
Henry clung to his mother, forcing the man to pry his fingers away one by one.
"Mother?"
he said as he was dragged away.
Mother!
She said nothing, watching him go. And then she was out of sight. 3 years earlier. When Henry and his mother had departed on their journey south to Tarragon, he had been excited. No, more than excited. He was going to see the world. He loved seeing the jealousy on the faces of his tormentors, the obnoxious youth of Night's End, who built themselves up by tearing him down. Most of them would never leave Night's End, much less go on a real voyage across a real sea. Their jealousy had grown even greater when they learned Henry and his mother were departing with the king's full blessing. And, for a while, the experience had been everything Henry had hoped it would be. Riding in a horse-drawn carriage along the western road, stopping in famed way-villages like Restor, teeming with travellers, merchants, and outlaws. Hiring seats with a floating barge company that roamed the Spear, riding the currents all the way to the ocean. Boarding a large merchant ship and riding the tumultuous waves over the burning sea. It had all been so wondrous that Henry hadn't even minded the seasickness. Now Henry wished he'd never left home. At first, Tarragon's capital city, Shai, hadn't been so bad, its red-skinned, copper-haired people welcoming, clamouring around Henry and his mother everywhere they went. The Terran men wore their hair long, occasionally braided down their backs, while the women's hair was shorn short, sometimes all the way to their scalps. In their own way, they were a beautiful people. The sights were beautiful, too, their dwellings resembling arrowheads, constructed of timber and rope, thatched with large frond leaves. Everything was new. The food, a contradictory mixture of spicy and sweet, was delicious. Their rituals, which involved little clothing and seductive dances, made Henry blush, all the more so because his mother sat right beside him. And yet he'd loved every minute. Everything changed when his mother got down to business, her true purpose for the journey. Revelation, as she'd said. She met with a man. His name was Corona, and he was Tarragon's equivalent of a fury, a holy man. Though the Terran people knew nothing of Roth, their god, Absence, was known to speak to Corona from time to time. Henry was not permitted to attend his mother's meetings. When she returned each day, there was something different about her, something foreign. Though she looked exactly the same, her hair and eyes the same colour, her skin the same shade, there was no mistaking the changes. She spoke differently, for one, her words charged with something Henry couldn't quite describe. When she spoke, it was like he couldn't not listen, like she held some power over him. She felt almost like a stranger. He didn't like the way it made him feel, but she was still his mother, his only friend, and he ignored the feelings, doing his best to remember that she was the same woman. It got worse. The first time he awoke in the middle of the night to find her on her knees, swaying side to side, murmuring indecipherable words under her breath, he was so scared he hid under the covers and pretended he was back in Night's End. The second time he tried to wake her, only to find her eyes rolled back in her head. He ran back to bed and once more dove under the covers. The third time he sat beside her, closed his eyes, and listened. Her words sent chills down his spine. She spoke of another war in the Four Kingdoms, one that would tear the realm apart for more than 100 years. She spoke of corpses, of cities running red with blood, of wild beasts tearing soldiers limb from limb. She spoke of death and destruction and the end of the world. The next day, Henry asked his mother how she knew these things. Her eyes widened. She didn't even know she'd spoken of them, a thought that scared Henry more than anything. "It's working," she said. "Corona's god holds great power, and he bestows a portion on me." Henry didn't know what that meant exactly, but before he could ask, his mother instructed him to write down everything she said the next time it happened. Henry did, sitting beside her in the firelight with quill and parchment, writing furiously so he didn't miss anything. It helped, the writing. It was something to focus on, rather than the meaning of her words. In the morning she read over his notes, nodding and murmuring and adding notations in the margins. "War is coming," she said when she'd finished. Henry shook his head.
"Mother, There is peace. Can't you see it? We would not be here otherwise.
It was true. None of the Southerners had accosted them at the southern border. Trade between the four kingdoms was flowing like the waters of the spear. The rulers of each realm were content with the land and wealth they had. War was a thing of the past.
It has already started, she said, ignoring him.
Henry knew there was no arguing with his mother, and anyway, what was the harm? She could think what she wanted. It wouldn't change reality.
There has to be a way to stop it, she said,
poring back over her notes. Henry watched her for a while, but it was as if he no longer existed, naught but a ghost. Finally, realizing she didn't need or want his input, he left, wandering aimlessly through the village. Well, not so aimlessly, perhaps, as eventually he found himself outside of Corona's holy circle of huts, the temple. In the center of the circle was a wide hole in the ground. Henry approached it, peeking over the edge. Nothingness poured from the space, a blackness so complete it seemed to suck the light from the air around it. Henry stumbled back, suddenly scared of falling to his death. After a few moments spent gathering his nerve, he scooped up a rock and moved toward the hole once more. He reached over the edge and dropped the stone, craning his ear and listening. Seconds passed, then minutes, then hours, the sun sinking towards the horizon, spilling fingers of red ink across the orange sky. Still he listened, desperate to hear something. The plop of the stone hitting water, the clink of the rock bouncing off the bottom. Something. Anything. Instead, the only sound was wind whistling through the circle of huts. And then a voice.
Absence.
Henry rolled over, spinning around. One leg slipped over the edge of the hole, and a portion of the ground cracked under his weight, tumbling away. The earth seemed to pull at him, the depths of nothingness like a giant hand grabbing his ankles and yanking. He was falling. He was dead.
No, worse than dead, Henry thought, his mind racing.
He would never land, falling forever and ever through utter darkness, until his stomach closed in on itself from lack of food, until his body shook and trembled from thirst, until his heart stopped beating in his chest. Even after he died, he knew. His corpse would continue its endless descent.
Whoosh!
His fall reversed course, as a strong hand grabbed his shirt and flung him upwards, tossing him back onto solid ground, where he landed with a thud that pounded the breath out of him. Corona, the priest, stood over him. His skin no longer looked bright red, darkening to deep crimson as night fell. His long coppery hair was tied in three places, a long rope that twisted over his shoulder, angled across his chest.
"You must be careful around Absence. She is an unforgiving god."
Henry struggled to breathe and talk at the same time.
"What have you done to my mother?"
The man cocked his head to the side. His skin was so smooth it could have been marble.
"Done to her? Nothing, youngling. I have simply opened a path that was hidden from her. She has chosen to go down it. Or perhaps the path has chosen her. Either way, she is destined for great things. She has the favor of two gods now, which is two more than most can claim."
Henry sat up, his breaths coming easier now.
"She's becoming paranoid. She's rambling at night."
Though the man tried to hide his surprise, Henry saw the slight twitch of his cheek.
"What does she say?"
"I don't know,"
Henry lied. His mother could tell Corona if she wished to.
The man mused. "Perhaps she is ready for the words."
"What words?"
"They are not meant for your ears, youngling. Now go. Your mother needs you."
Henry stood and started to leave, but then stopped.
"Does the hole have a bottom?"
"Absence has no bounds, no beginning nor end. It is, and it isn't. It takes away, but only after giving an equal portion."
Henry struggled to make sense of the man's words.
"So, don't fall in?"
he said.
"Don't fall in."
Henry returned to his mother, who had set aside Henry's notes and was preparing dinner like it was any other day. She didn't ask Henry about his day, and he didn't tell her what had transpired. 3 years later. Thinking about their journey to Tarragon 3 years earlier, Henry felt like his entire existence had been dictated by his mother's decisions. Until now, that had never really bothered him, even if he sometimes felt scared by what his mother did. But now he was angry. As he watched her being tied to the pyre amidst a barrage of jeers and thrown fruit, he wished he was stronger, more capable, a master of his destiny rather than a follower of hers. He wished he could save her. Is it too late? Even in her last words to him, she hadn't given him a choice. She'd fallen back into prophecy or sorcery, or something in between, he wasn't certain. And he knew, as she took her last breaths, she would expect him to search her words for meaning, to carry on her life's work, no matter what the cost to his own. I won't. His thoughts felt empty, meaningless, devoid of passion or feeling. I even lie to myself. I am nothing. I am nothing. I am... He closed his eyes, which were blurring again. His lips quivered. His legs shook. I am weak. I am broken. I am lost. The truths spoken in his mind were knives, cutting, carving, removing pieces of him on the butcher's block of fate. Though he hadn't eaten breakfast, the thought of knives and blood made his stomach heave. He vomited a stream of bitter brown liquid onto his fancy boots. The onlookers parted around him, muttering in disgust. An announcement was being made, a list of the charges his mother had been found guilty of. It was a long list. Henry had heard it all before, more times than he could count, and he didn't want to hear it again. Nor could he watch his mother burn. He turned away, pushing through the crowd. He could barely see through the tears in his eyes and the curtain of black curly hair that fell over his face. My hair is too long. It needs to be cut. The mundaneness of the thought sent a sharp jab of fear through his gut because, of course, his mother had always cut his hair. Who will cut it now? He jammed the heel of his hand into his forehead, chastising himself for his stupidity. His mother, the only person he had in the entire world, was about to be executed, and he was thinking about his hair? Cheers rose up, and the acrid smell of smoke bit at his nostrils. Tears dripped from his chin. He could feel the thick pages of parchment tucked under his shirt, scratching his skin. His mother's life work. Hide them across the kingdoms. More cheers. The bloodlust of the crowd pushing in from all sides. He choked on a sob, hiccuping. Stumbling, bouncing off of shoulders and elbows, jostled around. Alone amongst thousands. So alone. Alone. 3 years earlier.
The words have opened my mind, Henry's mother said. What words?
She shook her head. She wouldn't tell him either.
Corona and Mother have secrets between them, Henry thought bitterly. Mother used to tell me everything.
They are not, Henry cut her off.
Meant for my ears, I know.
She sighed.
I'm only trying to protect you, sweetness. Aye, because I'm too small, too weak, a coward. You are none of those things,
his mother snapped, and the power of her response made him flinch back.
I'm not? No. You are the future. What future? Our future.
His ears swallowed her words, relishing them. What had he been angry about a moment earlier? What had he been sad about? Whatever it was, it didn't matter. Because he had her, and that was enough.
I need you to help me again,
his mother said, roping an arm around him and pulling him close.
Anything, Mother?
Henry whispered.
I need you to write down my words again tonight. Don't miss a single one. Yes, Mother.
3 years later. Henry sat in the dirt, staring at a pile of ash and timber, broken stone and crumbling mortar. Not his mother. No, he was far too cowardly to go back to where she had been burned. No, this was his home. Someone had torched it while he was meandering aimlessly through the streets of Night's End. Everything he owned was inside. All of the coin his mother had left him, too, save for the few stallions that jangled around in his pockets. They wouldn't last long.
"I have no mother. I have no home. I have no wealth. Our future,"
his mother had said 3 years ago.
"You lied,"
he screamed now. They had no future, not together at least. The truth bit into his legs, arms, chest. And yet his tears were gone, long dried by the heat of the smouldering rubble, tracks of salt on his smoke-darkened face. He felt like he should continue crying, continue mourning until the sun exploded in the seventh heaven and the dueling moons crashed into each other in the night sky, surrounded by the flaming paths of falling stars.
"I should mourn forever. I should go back to Terrigen, to that hole, to absence, and throw myself into it. No."
His head jerked up. The last word was not his own. It wasn't even a thought, but a voice in his head, as clear as the ringing of a church bell. His mother's voice.
"Mother,"
he said aloud. Henry was dimly aware of people staring at him, pointing. They'd been watching him for a long time, wondering what he would do. And now he was talking to himself. They probably loved that. But he didn't care any more, because his mother had spoken to him.
"Yes, sweetness," she said. He gasped. It was her. I miss you. You don't have to, because I am with you, always. How is this possible? I don't know. Much of what I did in my life and afterwards, I don't fully understand. But I was chosen for this purpose, the moment I accepted the words. And what I did before I died was important. I must believe that.
Chosen by who?
Rolf? Maybe. Or absence, perhaps. I do not know. The one who showed me the way never gave me a name. It is all-seeing, all-hearing, the creator of the land, the sea, the air we breathe. It despises war and eschews evil. And the one will have peace again. It showed me the way.
What did you do?
You don't have to speak out loud, child. I can hear you.
Oh, I mean...
Oh. Yes, that's it. Speak to me where only I can hear.
Yes, mother.
Before I was taken, I performed a final spell.
What spell?
The rest of the words came to me in the dark. The words the fools said were false prophecies, the ravings of a dark sorceress. But they were not false, nor prophecies. They were promises. I cast the words across the land. The words were not only for the West, but for the entirety of the Four Kingdoms. The fate-marked shall come, and they shall bring death and chaos, and then peace.
At the final word, cool air blew across Henry's face, and he sighed. A smile creased his lips. Suddenly, he felt so happy. Everything was going to be fine. Somehow.
Some way. "I have your notes. I saved them from the fire. What do I need to do, mother?"
he asked.
"Trust yourself. Trust me. You have a role to play. As we all do. I don't understand."
No response.
"Mother?"
Silence.
"Mother!"
3 years earlier. His mother's words scared Henry, but he dutifully scrawled them down as quickly as she spoke them, only the whites of her eyes showing, gleaming in her head like full, pale moons. They were words of disaster and destruction and fear and violence. There was no hope in them, not tonight. But what scared him more was what she did when he finished writing, and her eyes rolled forward in her head. She looked not at him, but at the sheaves of parchment covered in Henry's handwriting, and grabbed them, crumpling them in her fist. Then she threw them into the fire, watching them burn to ash.
"Wrong, all wrong," she said. "I am deaf. I am blind. I need to get closer. I need to stay longer."
Shocked, his hand throbbing from writing for hours on end, Henry could do nothing but watch as she paced back and forth under the glow of the lantern light, which was growing dimmer as dawn beckoned from outside the opening in their conical hut. She'd spoken, and he'd written, all night. And she just destroyed every last word.
"Mother?"
Henry said. But it was as if he didn't exist. Not to his mother, at least. She continued pacing, back and forth, back and forth. Then, with swiftness that made Henry rock back in his chair, toppling over, she dashed for the opening in the hut, rushing outside. Exhausted, sore from writing and being hunched over a table all night, Henry wanted nothing more than to crawl into bed and sleep the day away. But he didn't. No, this time he followed his mother, keeping his distance so she wouldn't see him. He wasn't certain such stealth was necessary. She probably wouldn't even notice him if he sprang in front of her naked with his tongue out, but he thought it better to be cautious, given her current state of mind. Eventually she reached her destination, the circle of temple huts, and slipped inside the ring. Henry crept forward, hugging the shadowy side of one of the huts, which faced away from the rising sun. The thin, red-skinned priest, Corona, was waiting for her with a rope. His hair was free of bindings today, fanning out down his back.
"I warned you," he said.
"I'm sorry. I thought I was ready. I thought I knew the words."
"The words are not yours to know, nor mine. They are absences, and even those who listen in the darkness for years find themselves lacking."
"Lacking?"
"Yes. Your entire soul must be open before you can receive your deepest desire."
"Please, I need the darkness. I need to listen again."
"As you wish," Corona said.
He bent down and tied one end of the rope firmly to a metal hoop, pounded into the ground. Then he approached Henry's mother, who raised her hands over her head. To Henry's surprise, the priest tied the other end of the rope around her chest, under her armpits. She lowered her arms.
"No,"
Henry thought.
"Mother, what are you doing?"
He took a step forward, but she moved too quickly, stepping over the edge of the dark hole without a sound. Henry stopped, still in the shadows, watching as the coils of rope unwound, dropping into the pit. He held his breath. The tether went taut, reaching its limit, pulling on the hook, which tilted slightly in the direction of the hole, and held. A snake of uneasiness wormed its way into Henry's stomach as he thought about his mother down there all alone in the dark.
"It's just a hole,"
he thought, trying to convince himself.
"When she's finished doing whatever it is she's doing, listening to the words, Corona will pull her back up and she'll be the same eccentric woman she has always been. My mother."
He sat down to wait. Hours passed, the sun creeping across the sky, stealing Henry's shadow bit by bit, until he was forced to move to remain hidden. Corona sat by the hole, his legs dangling over the edge, staring silently into the darkness. He didn't seem to mind the heat beating down upon his head and shoulders. After what seemed like an eternity, the man stood up and began walking circles around the hole, muttering something under his breath. Henry cupped a hand to his ear and leaned forward, trying to make out the words, catching a few.
"Too long. No one is above. Have no choice. My duty. My duty. My duty."
The priest repeated the last two words several times before stopping suddenly, racing to one of the temple huts, his hair streaming like a wind-blown cape behind him, and emerging a moment later with a small but sharp-looking knife. Henry jolted, watching as the man strode back toward the hole, a look of determination on his arrowhead-shaped face.
He's going to cut the rope,
Henry realized with a start. He sprang to his feet, flying from hiding, moving so fast his feet barely seemed to